where transcription was not mechanical labor, but spiritual devotion, and where logical analysis became an act of worship. Syllogisms were not mere games of intellect, but pathways to divine order. Scholasticism absorbed Aristotle, baptized him, and transformed his natural philosophy into a tool of theology, a ladder leading from the classification of the world to contemplation of its first cause. The monastery, in this light, was not a retreat from the world, but a spiritual laboratory. In its silence, attention to the written word deepened. Its meaning was examined as one might examine the facets of a gem. Philosophy here was an act of service, an ascent toward truth through disciplined reflection. Every argument was a prayer in disguise, every syllogism a kind of liturgy of reason. Within these cloisters, the intellectual seeds were sown that would one day blossom into the universities, the organized structures of learning that gave reason its first institutional home, though still under the authority of theology. The rise of the universities marked a new stage in the dialogue between faith and intellect. They did not cast aside belief. They sought to organize it, to render knowledge systematic, and to establish the rules of scholarly debate. Bologna, Paris, and Oxford became not merely schools, but living embodiments of the medieval conviction that wisdom and holiness belong together. The disputatio, the formal debate, was their intellectual heartbeat, a disciplined exercise where reason could stretch its limbs, yet always within the bounds of orthodoxy. It was not a revolt against dogma, but an effort to attain the highest clarity within it. And in that very rigor, the first seeds of intellectual freedom began to germinate. For in learning how to distinguish, question, and define, thought was unknowingly preparing itself for an age when it would stand on its own. To follow this journey from the monk's silent cell to the scholar's lectern, from unquestioned revelation to the tentative steps of critical reasoning, is to witness how the mind, initially bound by faith's golden chains, learned to perceive, to classify, and to discern the subtle shades between the given and the understood. Without renouncing the sacred, it learned to think. The slow movement from obedience to inquiry, from illumination received to illumination sought, forms the thread of this book. It traces how medieval philosophy, beginning with the reverent acceptance of truth as divine gift, advances toward the bold attempt to grasp it by the powers of the human mind itself. Before each chapter, I have placed a short imaginary conversation with a representative of the era. These dialogues are not exercises in fiction, nor claims to historical authenticity. Their purpose is to give philosophy back its voice, to make thought speak again in the accents of the living. Reading medieval treatises often feels like speaking to marble statues, yet behind every one of them was a breathing soul, a man who prayed, doubted, suffered, and hoped. Through these imagined exchanges, we can hear the tones that the written treatises conceal. Thomas Aquinas does not merely quote Aristotle. He breathes the serene confidence of an architect building the edifice of reason. Augustine does not argue, he confesses. Occam smiles with a razor-edged irony. Meister Eckhart speaks in near silence. Through their imagined voices, the reader may come to sense